You Are Not So Smart is part of the Boing Boing family of podcasts. Find more podcasts at boingboingpodcasts.com. Welcome to the You Are Not So Smart podcast, episode 83. So I want to ask you a couple of really quick hits, and then we'll get into some more in-depth stuff. And I think this is really fun to ask an actual scientist why this is. Why do we get motion sickness?
Well, a couple of theories around, but the most common theory, which due to some accidental viral media story, people are attributing to me as if I discovered it, which I did not when I discovered it.
This is neuroscientist Dean Burnett, who's written a new book, Idiot Brain.
It does appear to be, I call it a glitch, but it's not even that really. It's a deliberate thing, but it's not used appropriately. So when we are in motion under our own steam, under our own power, we are walking and traveling along by our own ambulation. There's a very specific set of sensory feeds coming into the brain at the most fundamental level, like areas like the thalamus, which are where all the basic information, the raw data, is processed into something usable.
As a neuroscientist, Dean knows that the brain is quite fallible. It's the seat of consciousness and the engine of all human experience, he writes in his book, but it also has some very haphazard properties, and there are some things it doesn't do so well. For instance, we get motion sickness, and as Dean explains, it's because our brain is very, 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 very good at understanding where our bodies are in space. It's constantly receiving inputs from the body about where the body is, the pressure against it, its contact with surfaces, acceleration, balance, and so on. And that's all fine-tuned for walking and running and moving around, but just under the power of our bodies alone.
That's actually really quite consistent, really quite sort of all neat and tidy. The brain's going great. We are walking. That's marvelous. But in the most fundamental areas of the brain, the more primitive parts, which do all this, they haven't really had time, in an evolutionary sense, to get used to artificial movement, transport, vehicles. And these provide a different set of sensations. So when you're sat in a car or a ship or a plane or whatever it is, you are sort of motionless in a more physical sense. Your body isn't moving and you don't have any signals about that. And you're also within a contained environment, especially on a ship or something like that, where your eyes can't see any signs of movement. So all these senses are telling the brain that we are still, we are not moving. But the balance sensors in your ears, which respond to physics, they are saying we're moving quite a lot, sort of sloshing up and down, especially in a vehicle. We're a lot faster and the movement's a lot more pronounced. So the brain's getting two different senses. It's got mixed messages, and it's saying, half of them saying that we're still, half of them saying we're moving. That's not right. And the most fundamental areas of the brain don't really grasp why that could be happening. The only thing they can think of is we're perceiving nothing, but we are moving, so we must be hallucinating. The only thing that can cause that is a neurotoxin, so you're being poisoned, just throw up, on the off chance that it's actually the case. So think of it like, back to the computer analogy, think of vomiting as the brain's reboot. Just like, I don't know what's going on, just turn it off and on again, hopefully they'll fix it, and then we'll get back to normal.
We've all been there.
Yes, exactly. There are plenty of ways to trigger that reflex, I suppose.
I'm not sure where I should be. There's so many things that are great about that, and one is that is this the illusion that you have control of all these things, and sometimes you're just most of the time you're just having to deal with the brain that you have and what it's going to do in that situation. And another one is just these survival mechanisms or these adaptations that are obviously useful because they're part of our catalog of responses to the natural world. But our modern world has changed and advanced so quickly that I just think about how this is a physical reaction, and there must be many other things that we do behaviorally or cognitively that involve just thinking about the world that are also throwbacks to a previous time. And of course, you know, that gets into so much speculation. But the fact that we have motion sickness sort of, for me, is evidence that aside from however the just-so stories we might come up with, there has to be truth to the fact that we are we're not completely set up to navigate the modern world by default.
No, exactly. And we haven't really had time yet in terms of, you know, the more fundamental aspects of the brain haven't had a chance to evolve that sort of deeply ingrained ability to understand things like that. But it's almost like a victim of its own success in that we have developed this formidable intelligence, despite what, you know, some people might think. We are incredibly smart creatures, especially on the scale of, you know, on the sense of nature and the wider world. And we have been able to sort of modify the environment and to remove all the dangers and remove all the hazards. And, you know, we've actually been able to invent technologies and different processes and remove any sort of dangers and treat illnesses and stuff. But we've made our own environment more complex than our own brains are technically able to handle in many ways. So, again, it's sort of shot itself in the foot or the frontal lobe. It depends what, you know, I don't know which bit of the brain would shoot the other bit, but it is sort of self-sabotage, essentially, but not intentionally so. So, yeah, we are in a weird situation where our own brains have become sort of the architects of their own confusion.
On this episode of the You Are Not So Smart podcast, we explore our idiot brain with neuroscientist, professor, guardian blogger, Dean Burnett. We discuss irrational fears, the imposter syndrome, whether brain training actually works, and why breakups hurt physically. All that after this break. It's been said that we should surround ourselves with people who are smarter than us and benefit from their knowledge and keep ourselves challenged. And that's why I love having unlimited access to the Great Courses Plus. And I keep encouraging you to sign up too. Learn from award-winning professors and experts about whatever interests you, whenever you want. Build playlists, deep dive into your favorite topics, and just gather together a bunch of information about things that you didn't know in the first place. And the Great Courses Plus has engaging on-demand video lectures in thousands of different topics. They're easy to fit into your schedule. You can watch them anytime, at home, the gym, a break at work, and you can start and resume from any device. I just watched their course, Games People Play, Game Theory in Life, Business, and Beyond. Game theory, the scientific study of interactive rational decision making. This is such cool stuff. You get 24 lessons in this lecture. And one of the, I think my favorite one is about voting, because when you apply what we've learned from game theory to voting, you can see that there is no ranking. There's no way you can present the choices of candidates without presenting some sort of problem. Every way that you present the candidates will affect the way people choose. And you get to learn all about how that works and how it can be avoided as best we can in this lecture series. I want you to sign up for this because you can start streaming courses just like this one. And right now, as one of my listeners, you will immediately get a free month of unlimited access to all of the Great Courses lectures, all of them, when you sign up. So start your free month today by going to thegreatcoursesplus.com/smart. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/smart. And now we return to our program. I'm David McCraney. This is the You Are Not So Smart podcast. And our guest is...
I'm Dean Burnett. I'm a doctor of neuroscience, psychiatry and psychology lecturer for Cardiff University. Also a science writer for The Guardian, and have my new book out, Idiot Brain, What Your Head Is Really Up To.
And I'm really happy to get a chance to talk to you. That was really fun. It was strange. I blurbed your book. I read most of your book after a tornado scare. My wife and I had to leave our house, and we went and got a hotel room north of where we live, and then I had the book with me, and then I read it in there, and then blurbed it right there from the hotel room. It was great.
Yes, well, when I wrote it, I thought this will be really suitable for anyone escaping a tornado. That was my target audience, so that is probably the best way to read it.
All right, so I want to just start out with saying, I guess every age likes to use some sort of metaphor for the brain, and our age, and for a very long time, I guess it used to be used to be all about steam power and hydraulics and building up frustrations and anger. And now it's all about programming and computers and modules. But you assert pretty early on in the book that if the brain is a computer, it's not a really great one. Why is calling the brain a computer sort of a bad analogy by your account?
Well, I'll say first off that I understand where it comes from, because the brain is like the most complicated thing, and it does all these different functions and roles and processes, which are extremely hard to get your head around. And in the sort of the everyday world, a computer would be the sort of the closest thing you can think of, which does similar things, like all this processing and information management and all that. So I get where it comes from. But again, as you say, it's kind of a misleading metaphor, in that computers are designed and sort of constructed to fulfill certain roles, and the brain, for want of a better term, isn't. Despite what some fundamentalists might say, that it's an evolved organism. It doesn't do things as efficiently as a computer would, or as fast as it would, because it hasn't been designed. It's more like natural selection. It's ended up the way it is due to trial and error over time. But that doesn't mean it's does the most efficient thing, the most logical thing. And to expect it to be like a computer, as regimented, as ordered as that, is perhaps asking too much of it. And also it sort of draws perhaps false comparisons, in that the idea that memory, for example, is just a big data bank full of information that we can access at will, isn't how human memory works. It's far more fluid, far more flexible, far more organic, and far more malleable. It's not as reliable as that. And I think I say in the book, I compare it to, imagine a computer which just rearranged your files for you and just put the best ones on top, and then suddenly presented you with files that you didn't ever want to think about again, for no reason other than it just decided that's a good idea. That would be a bad computer, and that's sort of what the brain does all the time, but by orders of magnitude more frustrating. So yeah, there are many ways in which it isn't like a computer, which sort of the using the analogy will perhaps be distracting or even upsetting to some people, to think like, oh, it shouldn't do that, but it does, because it's not a computer. And there probably are other reasons too.
I think a lot of people are noticing this lately. If you've read Steven Pinker's book about the better angels of our nature, or there are lots of places you can find that on many scales, the world has become safer. There's less war. There's less crime. There's less murder. There's less. There's more prosperity. There are all these measures of the world that show that things are a lot better now than they were just 20 years ago. Yet there is a strong feeling. I know this is especially true in my country. That the world's going to hell, and that we're all doomed. We're circling the drain. There's a lot of fear. And you write about the fear in the book a good bit. And I think there's this strange thing where we think the world is more dangerous than it ever has been, when it's actually safer than it ever has been. What do you think is? What are your thoughts on the sort of climate of fear and the climate of fearfulness, and what's fueling all that?
I think there's several different sort of causes, or at least influences, on this general idea that the world's a more dangerous and scary place, despite the evidence. In that, at the most fundamental level, the brain isn't really adapted or evolved to take in raw data like that sense. So you can show anyone sort of any number of graphs or scales, or printed out dissertations and theses and studies, which show that the world is overall a safer, better place to be in, and a lot more prosperity and a lot more harmonious, even, because there are a lot less wars these days. But that's just a very abstract bit of information, whereas someone who has been sort of mugged, or has seen on the news someone being horribly unkind to someone else, that's a far more visceral, a far more emotive sort of bit of information, and the brain's far more keyed to look, sort of pay attention to and remember the more emotional, evocative things like that, because that's sort of how we live our lives. It's a sort of series of moments rather than abstract data, which is sort of why revising for an exam can be so tricky, when it's as opposed to remembering something next from your life is a lot easier. So we are sort of keyed to recognize more fundamental things like, you know, crime and horrible atrocities happening than we are to just recognize abstract information. And I think the way we, you know, that's sort of fed into how the media works too, not just the media, but any sort of information or news platform. Because, you know, when you say crime isn't happening isn't really a story. A crime happening is interesting and gets people's attention, whereas 50,000 people weren't shot today is less of a, you know, it's less of a newsworthy thing, even though it shouldn't be. And so, like, the media itself is always going to look for stories and scoops and sort of unpleasant things happening. And we do have a sort of tendency to focus on and retain negative things from the outside world, because even at a chemical level, like when we experience fear or upset or anything unpleasant, there's a sort of low-level cortisol release, the stress hormone, and that sort of, you know, gives us the negative feelings and the negative responses we have to things like that. But that endures in the bloodstream a lot longer than the more pleasant things like oxytocin or, you know, endorphins and stuff. This stress hormone lingers. And I think the brain is sort of key to look for threats, and anything unpleasant would, you know, at a very fundamental level, triggers off the perhaps threat recognition. And it just also comes down to the fact that we have a lot more access to information now. So we are, for the first time perhaps ever in our society, able to see all around the world, and you give them a moment's notice, all the horrible things that are going on, especially things like social networks, Twitter and Facebook and all that. Someone who's, you know, just had a horrible thing happen to them can then go directly online and say, this horrible thing just happened to me. And that can be shared by 20,000 people, then 50,000, then 100,000, then it's gone worldwide. And you would never have known before. I mean, that, you know, that sort of occurrence could be less common now, but it's far more common to just know that it's happened. And as a result, it just seems like more things like this are happening. Not to say that things, you know, don't need to be improved, and there are plenty of problems which don't need resolving, but we're a lot more aware of them now just because we can be. And as a result, it's going to scare people. And no, change itself is also quite scary to a lot of people. And when we're a far more interconnected society, people who are different to you come out, you know, far more common, far more visible. And that, for some people, can be quite uncomfortable, even though, you know, that's not really an excuse, but it is a thing.
That is interesting. The our access to the information has increased, but the actual fearful information may have gone in the other direction. It's another case of trying to adapt to a modern world that is just different. Different from, you know, there's a lag period, a biological lag. This is what you're just talking about there. There's something you just talk about in the book, and I think this is something that we've all wondered, or at least I wonder this constantly, because if you live a semi-public life, or if you spend any time on social media, you know that criticism is more powerful than praise, and one negative comment can just rattle around in your head for weeks, and is more powerful than 100 pats on the back. What does the science have to say about why that is?
There are quite a few possible explanations for that as well, in that a lot of it comes down to the fact that we are, surprisingly, you know, compared to what you see in the news, of course, we are a very sociable and very friendly species. And as a result of this, we tend to, you know, sort of, it could be due to the fact that we've evolved this way. That's the social brain hypothesis, in that we have big brains because we evolved in tight-knit communities, whereby we sort of counted on other people in our community we weren't related to. So the ability to have friends, be able to retain like your relationship with this person in your head, and that requires a lot more information processing ability. And as a result, we sort of an evolutionary drive to develop big brains which can hold all these different relationships in our head at any one time. But when you evolve in a sort of tight-knit community where your survival depends on being part of a community, being rejected by, you know, your peers, your friends, your community, your tribe folk, that's almost like a death sentence. You know, when you're struggling to survive in the savannah, like a tight-knit little community, and you get excommunicated or get kicked out, then you're on your own, and that's not a good place for a primitive primate to be. So sort of general fear and sort of dislike of being rejected by people is seemingly underlying in most humans. And as a result, when someone does criticize us, it can trigger off as a potential threat response, which is a lot more potent than just the general sort of praise. Because we, you know, as well as that, we also, generally, we live in a society where, you know, manners are sort of important and there's just general etiquette. So someone being nice to you, to your face, is the norm. So as a result, someone being unpleasant to you is more novel. And the more novel something is, the more salient it is, the more, you know, stimulating, the more striking it is. And as a result, we end up being quite sensitive to any sort of negative stimulus from another person. And, you know, it's generally perceived as a threat. It's very novel. It's not something we like anyway. And the brain does have a tendency to focus on negative things more than positive. But that's that seems to be a just general combination of how we've evolved. So we've evolved to, you know, sticks and stones don't break your bones, but they are unpleasant. And that's, names are unpleasant, I mean. And it's sort of like I say in the book, if names will never hurt you, why is there a phrase to say that? If they didn't hurt you, you wouldn't think of it to invent one. So obviously they do hurt. It's just not as physically damaging as an actual beating.
That relates to another thing that I think was just so, as soon as when I saw the heading in a book, I was like, oh, this is such a good, I'm so glad that somebody put this in a book from a scientific point of view. We've all experienced this, and I'd like to hear what you have to say about why is it then, and this is related to the ostracism that you're talking about, but why is it that a breakup, a relationship breakup, why does that really, really just throw us for such a loop? Why does it hurt so much?
Well, say when you are in a relationship, it's not just, you know, the fact is, like I think I say in the book, but objectively, what's happened to you is someone you've spent a lot of time with, you won't spend as much time with them now. And from a completely objective, rational viewpoint, that doesn't sound so bad. But from a subjective point of view, it's awful, absolutely awful. And there are many, many things that happen to you when you end up in a relationship with someone, particularly a long-term one. And, you know, for example, like the oxytocin action, like when you start being intimate with someone at any level, really, you, the oxytocin release, you actually become sort of, your brain adapts to them. That's where you can go from sort of just being just pure physical attraction to genuine affection, then comfortable, then sort of association. And the relationships go through phases as you adapt to someone. And the longer you spend with someone, the more they are a part of your life. They're the part of your normal everyday routine. And the brain does not like change generally because it likes things to be predictable. It likes things to be certain. Uncertainty is something the brain doesn't like at all. And then, of course, you build a life with someone. So like, even if you just move in together or you have several close friends, groups of friends, you have plans, you have routines, you have, you know, shared memories. And that's suddenly taken away from you. So someone breaks up with you or they've not been particularly faithful, whatever the cause, this causes a serious, you know, massive backlash in, you know, internally. First off, it's because, you know, all of your certainties, all of your daily routines, they've now been kicked from under you. So now you don't know what's going to happen. You don't know how things are going to pan out. You don't know what's going to happen next. You are obviously, you know, am I ever going to find love again? That's a big concern for many people. And that's really upsetting because obviously it throws a lot of uncertainty at you, which the brain doesn't like. And then you also have all these nice memories of your relationship and all the things that happened. Now, all these are sort of tinged with a negative thing too. So it cuts really sort of deep to the core of your being in that all of these pleasant memories now have a negative spin on them and a sort of a negative association, which, you know, that's, your memories are a big part of your identity. So you end up associating your identity with this person and then you lose that as well. That's a real shock to the brain. The way our cognitive things work, all our sort of preset maps of the world, or our ideas how things work, or our schemas, or our thought processes, they are, you know, assuming this person is going to be there, and now they're not. And that's a big blow to the brain. Like, it takes a lot of time to get over that and to sort of rebuild and reassemble. And when something that sort of emotionally visceral hits you, it does tend to trigger off the same sort of pain responses and sort of, you know, noxious stimuli that would a genuine physical pain would cause. So it sort of triggers the same areas, and some studies show that, you know, painkillers actually do make you feel better after a breakup rather than just after a serious injury. Because, you know, it's still an injury, just more of a psychological one than a physical one. So, you know, people, if you want to mope on your couch for several days, you know, eating chips and staring at the screen, I think you're entitled to that. It's almost like intensive care, but not quite, not so many beeps.
And now we take a break from our show for a word from our sponsor. A few weeks ago, my wife and I cooked a meal from Blue Apron at my parents' house. I brought over all the ingredients that came in the mail and made chicken meatloaf with mashed potatoes and green beans, and it was phenomenal. I loved cooking with my mom, reading about the different ingredients off of the material that came with the recipe, and the final product fed the four of us no problem. Cooking together builds strong family bonds, and research shows that Blue Apron families cook nearly three times more often. Those who spend a lot eating out or at high-end grocery chains can now spend under $10 per person for a healthy, delicious meal. Blue Apron delivers seasonal recipes along with pre-portioned ingredients to make delicious home-cooked meals, and they know that when you cook with incredible ingredients, you make incredible meals. So they set the highest quality standards for their community of artisanal suppliers, family-run farms, fisheries, and ranchers. Whether it's Japanese ramen noodles, wild-caught Alaskan salmon, or heirloom tomatoes, Blue Apron is bringing you the best. Here are the meals that are available in August. Spiced pork burgers with goat cheese and cucumber corn salad. Summer vegetables with quinoa bowl and fairy tale eggplants. Shishito peppers and corn. Oh, I want this now. Chicken tinga tacos with summer squash and tomato salsa. Check out this week's menu and get your first three meals free with shipping by going to blueapron.com/YANSS. Yes, I said that. Three free meals. You will love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. So don't wait. That's blueapron.com/YANSS. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. And now we return to our program. So I want to move away from that stuff. Into there are two things you talk about in the book that I really are really in my wheelhouse. Things that I'm really fascinated with, and that we've sort of talked about a lot on the show in the last 10 or 15 episodes. And one of those is arguing. And there you say something in the book that I had never seen it this way, but I like the idea of it. And if you could just kind of walk the listeners through, sort of, you have this interesting thesis statement about when the situation that we find ourselves in quite a bit in modern life, especially on social media, is you find yourself debating or arguing with someone who you know is wrong and you know you're right, and they think the same thing. And you sort of couch this as an imbalance between the imposter syndrome and the Dunning-Kruger effect. And we've had David Dunning on the show, and he's talked about the Dunning-Kruger effect. So people are going to understand what that is, kind of, but it's okay to sort of refresh their memory. But I would like to hear you sort of walk us through this battle of cognitive malfunctions or cognitive weaknesses that ends up making us really poor debaters.
Well, let's say it's a combination of people who have lower intelligence not realizing that, and people of higher intelligence realizing how much they don't know. So the imposter syndrome, for those who don't know, is the weird phenomenon whereby people who are high achievers, particularly in academia or anything sort of high-flying like that, or like high legal firms or the tech industry, they've worked their way up through, you know, their own efforts and their own learning and their own sort of successes. But when they're at the sort of a certain high level, there's always a sort of a constant bias and like a negative bias against their own abilities. They think that everyone around them is competent and knows what they're doing, whereas they aren't certain and are just bluffing it, and eventually they're going to be found out, so everyone feels like they're an imposter. Now, normally in this case, it's a lot of people around them are actually feeling the exact same thing, just like it's a conspiracy of silence, and no one dares mention it. But it isn't the case, because these people are fully qualified to be there and allowed to be there, and they know what they're doing, and they get away with it because they're doing it correctly. But there's always this sort of in a nagging doubt, because the more intelligent you are, perhaps the more you learn, that just sort of reveals more and more how much you don't know, because it's kind of impossible for one human being to know everything, literally everything, especially about any single field. Like, there's no musician who knows all music, there's no scientist who knows all science, despite what the media would always believe when they say, scientists say, no, they don't. There's plenty of ones who don't say that, trust me on this. And, but no, so like, it's a consequence of people who have high intelligence It's not always the case, of course. I know I've met many professors who are convinced they are the center of the universe and will not take any disagreement with this. But it is, you know, it's quite common in sort of the high achieving intellectual type of field. Whereas contrast that with someone of low intelligence, I think the problem with it is that a lot of things require intelligence, and one of the things that requires intelligence is the ability to successfully assess your own intelligence, to be aware of how intelligent you are and how intelligent other people are. So that requires a degree of intelligence. Now, if your own intelligence is lower than what's needed to be able to recognize how low it is, then you have no reason or no ability to recognize that you are unintelligent and have no reason to doubt yourself. So you can say things with the utmost confidence and or believe things thinking you're right, because you know, the idea that someone else might know more than you isn't something you can really appreciate at a tangible level. So you end up with people who are supremely confident, and because they don't know why they shouldn't be, because they don't have the intelligence to recognize that they are not clever people, and they end up doing extremely confident, ridiculous things, like run for president. That's one example. And you know, that's just off the top of my head. Yeah, I'm not naming names, but that is one possible occurrence of this. And then when you have two people on the opposite end of the scale, one supremely confident for no and not having any clue why they shouldn't be, and one very doubtful because they know all the different things they don't know, and obviously the confident person is going to be far more effective in an argument, because it just comes down to one-on-one who gives up first. The confident person has no reason to give up or change their mind, so they don't. And just general, like over time, people just get worn down by the constant bludgeoning of ridiculous claims.
Well, that's the internet in a nutshell. The constant constant bludgeoning over ridiculous things.
Yes. Oh, next book title.
You also mentioned, and part of this is and you don't see this everywhere, but you definitely see this from time to time, a sort of anti-intellectualism can in certain pockets of the world that goes beyond just saying, you know, look at this nerd. It's worse than that. It's like, what are these scientists going to say next? Or I remember very clearly Sarah Palin getting really, really upset that scientists were trying to study fruit flies. And she was like, what are we trying to do? Like, what do we need to know about fruit flies? And there is this sort of undercurrent of anti-intellectualism. And I wonder, you mentioned it in the book, like what is fueling that from your perspective?
Anti-intellectualism, I think it might come down to the fact that, like I said earlier on, there's a lot more information around now. So people can have access to more information and feel like they are perhaps better informed than they would have done a while ago. And it obviously comes out of the fact that not all the information you can access is useful or any good or in any way accurate, but it is there, which is obviously some people don't have the training or the experience to differentiate between good and bad information. As you can see from anyone, if you have an older relative who's on Facebook who shares things on there which are like absolutely ludicrous, but you can't possibly argue because it'll make Thanksgiving awkward. And you know, that's the sort of thing which people have. If you have your own opinion now, you can find out. You can find something which will agree with you, which looks official but isn't. But that's probably part of it. There's also like sort of an underlying. People are very aware of their social status. That's another consequence of evolving as part of a social group. But we also have social hierarchies. Like everyone wants to be the best. Everyone wants to be like the top of the tree. We want to be the alpha male and all those other cliches. We want to be liked, we want to be respected. Now, I think you contrast that when you see, like, the Olympics just finished at the moment, and you see someone, like, run the Olympics or, like, do some completely incredible stuff, that's brilliant. It's really impressive, but I think people can understand that. You look at someone who's, like, a trained gymnast or an excellent sprinter or a weightlifter, you think, yeah, it's really impressive, but I could do that if I just trained all my life like they have. So it's more like, I could do that, I just haven't, I just choose not to. Which is obviously not the case, but it's not as it's understandable. Whereas someone who's more intelligent and more informed than you, there's no way to really, people can't quite grasp that as much. That's seen as more of a threat, perhaps, to someone's status, someone's identity, because they could tell you that you're wrong about something, and that's really... Because I work in psychiatry, and when you tell someone you work in psychiatry, they get very, very suspicious and very sort of standoffish quite quickly a lot of the time. Like, oh, well, don't diagnose me. I wasn't going to. I'm not on duty, and I'm not actually a psychiatrist. I just work in the field. But people are very suspicious and paranoid about it because they don't know. Like, they can't anticipate it because someone being stronger than you, that's, you know, you can figure that out, whereas someone being more intelligent is unsettling in that way because it's not something you can really, you know, you couldn't figure out how to come back to that or how to compensate for that if you were up against a person. But it's also the fact that people who are sort of much more informed and more intelligent tend to be far more, you know, they'll tell the truth about what the data says, like scientists especially, like say, like climate change is happening. People think, well, I don't like that. That's bad for me. So I could agree and sort of try to work my entire life to reverse that trend or try and fix the planet, or I could just tell them they're lying. And that's, you know, it's far more easy for me to... The brain can be quite lazy in that respect. So rather than just try and take things on board and adapt and change to information, it's far more easy to just go, no, they're wrong. I'm not having that. And then sort of go about their way. So yeah, that's there's probably a lot of stuff like that going on, which contributes to this general lack of intellectualism. And also politics doesn't help either, because when you're trying to appeal to as many people as possible with, you know, the least amount of information, people demand intellectual arguments and insightful analysis. That's not very common, whereas people, like, you know, you need to have, you know, something more basic, something more generalist and something more crowd-pleasing. And it's kind of hard to convey intellectual arguments in that sense. So there's also been a shift towards sort of sound bites and quirky presentations and just more emotive things than anything more substantial in an information sense. And that's probably, you know, developed over time to have a strong streak of lack of anti-intellectualism, as we say.
Yeah. Well, that's another fantastic, beautiful segue into the last thing I wanted to talk to you about, which was just intelligence itself. There's this great George Carlin quote where he says, think of how stupid the average person is and realize half of them are stupider than that. And of course, he's talking about the median but not, instead of the average. But either way, I'm just wondering, is there any truth to that statement, Dean? Is there any truth to that? What does science have to say about this?
It's funny you mentioned that quote, actually. We have we had our education secretary in this country a few years back, Michael Gove, who was in charge of children's education, and he said he wants to make sure that all our school children are above average, which, you know, sort of a real head grabber, like, oh, for goodness sake, you're in charge of lives. And that's that was really quite disheartening for any educator, I think. It is, anyway, it's a weird thing in that I think when it comes to intelligence, it's a slippery subject, because a lot of scientists sort of disagree on what it actually is, and like, how would you define it in words? It's got a lot of definitions, and you know, I think people have a general understanding of it as a thing. But you have to ask someone to sit down and describe it accurately. It's kind of, you probably get lots of different definitions from lots of different people. Mm. It's sort of like seen as the ability to retain and process information at a high rate and effectively, and so on. So, but then that makes it quite tricky to measure, because it's not like weight or like muscle density or strength and like that. You can't have some sort of physical. There's a real physical element to it. So we have things like IQ tests, which are not actually just... It's not like a scale as you step on and get a weight, which is completely accurate. It's more reflective of the average population intelligence. So the average intelligence of a population, according to IQ tests, is always 100, no matter where you are. As long as the sample used was reflective of that population when the test was made, it's a 100. So, like, you say if tomorrow some bizarrely specific virus wiped out everyone in the United States with an IQ of over 100, the IQ the next day would still be 100. It would just be, you know, worth less, like a currency being devalued. Mm. And, yeah, so, yeah, the average person is going to be, you know, the average person does literally have an IQ of 100. It's just that what that average person, you know, can do is different from population to population. So yeah, there is some truth to that, but it's a very slippery scientific subject, especially with neuroscientific sense, because it's kind of hard to see intelligence in the brain, because it doesn't come from one particular spot or anything like that. It's more of a gestalt, an emergent property of all the different things we can do.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, intelligence is such an interesting idea in of itself, because we're obviously in an age now where we have a lot of our personal truths, and we question people. We have a lot of tribal behavior. We have a lot of social truths, and I often find people thinking, you know, that person's really book smart. You know, those are the kind of things you'll hear people say. They'll recognize people's problem solving abilities, but they'll think that all their conclusions are bad. And it is true that, you know, they're in the research into things like conspiracy theories or bias or whatever, that the more intelligent a person is by some measures, the better they are at conjuring those sorts of concepts and keeping them and protecting them. And so you talk about in the book, what is the difference between fluid and crystallized intelligence?
Well, fluid and crystallized intelligence is one way in which some scientists break down intelligence into components or in sort of subtypes. And crystallized intelligence would, again, I said it on, like, I don't like it, but I keep using it, the computer analogy, to make it as easily understandable as possible. Crystallized intelligence would be like the hard drive. That's where all the information is, all the data, all the stuff that you can access and use at any point. So, like, the more you learn, all the facts you learn, this is crystallized intelligence. So a quiz show would be an example of, you know, that test purely, assuming it's a traditional quiz show, not one of those sort of newfangled ones with all the whistles and bells, it would be an example of crystallized intelligence, testing crystallized intelligence. The more information you can remember and have access to suggests you have more of a greater crystallized intelligence, whereas fluid intelligence would be the ability to use this information and extrapolate and derive conclusions and make connections. And so that would be sort of like the processor on a computer, in that it's the bit which uses information. It's got smaller capacity. It's got sort of like, it's not as copious, but it is actually, it's more active. It does stuff. And so, like, something like Sherlock Holmes, when you see him on one of his various manifestations in modern media, you seem to look at a scene and then make all these connections and links and refer back and work out what's going where. That would be fluid intelligence, because he's using information, he's using it and processing it and doing things with it. And you know, crystallized intelligence would just be the information he has in his head and has access to, like a language you've learned. That's sort of like crystallized intelligence, the ability to work out what, you know, this word means in a different language. That is fluid intelligence. And yeah, so the divide is there, and crystallized intelligence doesn't seem to ever stop as you get older. Well, no one's lived long enough yet to fill the brain, as it were. And, I mean, I don't know what you do about that. If you did, like, you can't even go to the doctors and say, like, my brain is full. Well, what do you treat that? Sorry, I'm full. It's just completely full.
So, is there any truth to the to these various brain training programs and apps and services that you see all over the place?
Well, this is a tricky one for me to answer. Not because I don't have an answer. It's because these people tend to have money, and people with money tend to have lawyers. And a lot of people might hear this, so I can't really say completely outright that what I do think of these things. But I think from this preamble,
let me rephrase that. So, if I were to try to create an app that would make people smarter by using it every day, what does the science say about how well that app would work?
It would be very effective at training people to become better and more efficient at the tasks that app uses. And that seems to be the weird sort of consequence of the brain actually being very good at diversifying and being on specification. So something like, you know, for example, people have asked me, if I do a lot of crosswords, then is that going to make me smarter? Yes, if by smarter you mean better at crosswords, because the brain can do, it's very good at sort of subdivisions and being focused in that respect. It is quite an adaptive organ. And obviously that sort of skill would have knock-on effects to general word recognition and similar sort of language, perhaps, development. But there's no one thing we know of yet which will and can boost overall intelligence, because intelligence doesn't seem to work that way. Just like if you throw like a number game at your brain, it'll become better and better at that number game and still get lost, you know, in the supermarket if it's not really good at maps and stuff. And as a result, these creations do technically do what they claim to do, in that they do boost your brain power, but they boost it in a very, very limited focused way, which doesn't necessarily have much of a wider application for your life in general, unless you are unless you have a real sort of investment in being the best at number games, which some people do, I know, but that's not, you know, you don't get a lot of that in sort of your career support in school. It's not really recommended, and it is kind of they do work, but their applications are not as diverse as perhaps the marketing spiel would have us believe.
So don't put your high score on one of those games on your resume.
Well, you can if there's nothing else on there. I mean, that's kind of something. But yes, it's probably not. I mean, not don't put it on the first page anyway. People are going to put it under interests.
Thank you so much for being on the show, and thank you so much for making this really fun book.
No problem at all. Thanks very much for having me.
Dean Burnett's book is Idiot Brain, and you can find him over at The Guardian, where he blogs under the title Brain Flappings. By the way, you can support this show by going to patreon.com/youarenotsosmart. This week, I'm putting up an extra podcast, a completely extra podcast, an episode, a full episode, just for patrons. Up next, a cookie, and then the end credits.
Now, what starts with the letter C? Cookie starts with C. Let's think of other things that starts with C. Who cares about other things? C is for cookie.
On each episode of the You Are Not So Smart podcast, I eat a cookie baked from a recipe sent in by a listener or a reader of the books. And if we pick that recipe that was sent in by you and Mandy, my wife, if she cooks those cookies and then I eat them on the air, you will receive a signed copy of either You Are Not So Smart or You Are Now Less Dumb in the mail. To send in your recipes, send them to david@youarenotsosmart.com. And this episode, oh, what a treat. Let me pull this up so that I can read it to you. This came from the Clara Tea House, an email that came out of nowhere from the Clara Tea House. It said that they were big fans of the show and they would like to send me some tea to make this special cookie that you can make out of their tea. And I said, please do. And I got a package in the mail along with this email. The email says, we're pleased to inform you that a package is on its way. And inside of it, you will have a bag of our organic ceremonial grade matcha and an awesome recipe for some matcha cookies. And they said they hope to hear my thoughts on the You're Not So Smart podcast. And thank you from your biggest fans at the Clara Tea House. And this comes from Jose Acevedo, and he's the owner of the Clara Tea House. Clara Tea, you can find them at C-L-A-R-I-T-E-A, claritiehouse.com. And yes, it was gorgeous. They sent me this box in the mail, beautiful wrapping paper with ribbon around it. I open it up and it's a box, and I open the box and inside more wrapping paper and then a big bag of their tea powder and this recipe right here for matcha white chocolate chunk cookies. And these cookies are butter and brown sugar and granulated sugar and matcha powder and an egg and vanilla extract and baking soda and salt and all-purpose flour and pastry flour and white chocolate. And you'll have the recipe on the website and in the show notes. They are beautiful. They were green as Mandy was making them and they were being blended up. They were green, this really strange green powder. And they came out green with chunks of white chocolate nestled inside. They're very, very thin, very, very thin, and very, very light, as if they could just float right away. And I'm going to try one right now. So I'm going to move this out of the way, and here we go. These are unbelievable. Now this This goes in the pantheon of perfection. This is a cookie you have to make. This is a cookie that you will impress people with. Oh, man. So this cookie takes on many forms. It feels like a cookie in your hands, but when you bite into it, it gives like a brownie. But then when you're chewing it, it feels like maybe you just bit into thin crust pizza. And then the more you chew it, it just dissolves into like this buttery, creamy, tea-flavored chocolate mousse. Mm. And the edges are crispy. Mm. It's like it just keeps changing shapes, changing forms. It's a shapeshifter. It's like the sorceress in Willow, whenever she's keeps changing in all these different forms, including an ostrich, and it's just morphing back and forth. Well, ow. Mm. So many different kinds of cookie in one cookie. Ah. This is amazing. Oh, man. Clara Tea House, everyone. I can't say it enough. Clara Tea, Jose Acevedo, and your family, everyone who was involved in this and who put the package together, I can't thank you enough. Not just because of the wonderful thing you did, but I got to eat these cookies, and they are unbelievable. Mmm. And then I'm going to make some tea out of your tea. Ah, this is perfect, and I can't recommend it enough. Check out this, check out the recipe on the website, and check out the Clara Tea House. Mmm, delicious stuff. I can't wait to get another one of these cookies. Ah, great. And now I can feel the aftertaste. Mmm, and I can taste the tea. Mmm, so good. All right, Clara Tea House. Jose, a book is on its way. That is it for this episode of the You Are Not So Smart podcast. The opening music is Clash by Caravan Palace. You can find more great podcasts at boingboingpodcast.com. The show notes are at youarenotsosmart.com. All the previous episodes are on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, youarenotsosmart.com, and Patreon. Patreon.com/youarenotsosmart is where you can get extra stuff and support the show. You also get the show with no ads if you go over to Patreon. Find us on Facebook. Big things planned for Facebook, even though they changed their algorithm and you don't see us as often as you might have. There are 340,000 plus people on there who are fans of the show. Also, find us on Twitter. We are at NotSmartBlog, and I am at David McCraney. Send your cookie recipes to david@youarenotsosmart.com. More shows coming up soon about how to change people's minds and video games and Pokemon and so much more.